You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. I fell in love with Peter Godfrey Smith's book as soon as I heard the title, Other Minds, the Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness. I mean, come on, how can you not fall in love with it? I'd already heard about Inky. How many of you heard about Inky, who are here tonight? The octopus at the National Aquarium of New Zealand, who squeezed through a slight gap in the top of his tank, flopped to the floor, then slithered 8 feet overland to slide down a drain pipe more than 160 feet long, and finally to freedom in Hawke's Bay. Cephalopods, as Peter Godfrey Smith notes, are, quote, an island of mental complexity in the sea of invertebrate animals. I read Other Minds for the first time this summer, curled up among the rocks on the coast of Mendocino, and it was a good place to think about the ocean, as well as the octopus. As the author reminds us, the ocean is the original home of the mind. And as much as this book sheds light on the octopus brain, the human brain, and the evolution of consciousness, it's also a call to remember and protect the ocean itself as our source and our destiny. The octopus, writes Peter Godfrey Smith, has, quote, a body of outlandish and unbounded possibilities. The author is a man as well, I think, of unbounded curiosity. He suits up in scuba gear and dives into the sea to observe our noble cousins, the cephalopods, as a way in, he writes, to probing certain philosophical problems. Quote, if we want to understand other minds, he writes, the minds of cephalopods are the most other of all. It's the closest we can come, he says, to meeting an alien. Here are just a few of the questions that Peter Godfrey Smith seeks to answer when he suits up in scuba gear and dives down to Octopolis to observe the dens of its octopus inhabitants. What does it mean that higher intelligence on Earth has evolved not once, but twice? What could it be like to, quote, see with your skin? Do cuttlefish dream? What is the point of building a large nervous system if your life is over in a year or two? These are pretty interesting questions. And over the last several months, my colleagues at the Library Foundation and family and friends have been somewhat confounded by my unbounded enthusiasm for the subject of octopus consciousness. Tonight, I trust they will understand, and so will you. And I hope you enjoy thinking through these questions and reading this elegantly written and thought-provoking book as much as I have. Our guest tonight, Peter Godfrey Smith, is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and a professor of history and the philosophy of science at the University of Sydney. His four scholarly books include Theory and Reality, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Science, and Darwinian Populations and Natural Selection, which won the 2010 Lakatos Award for an outstanding work on the philosophy of science. And in conversation tonight, our go-to evolutionist, Dr. Amy Parrish, herself a researcher of boundless curiosity. Amy is a biological anthropologist, primatologist, and Darwinian feminist who has taught at USC in the Gender Studies, Arts and Letters, Anthropology, and Preventative Medicine programs since 1999. And for the last 20 years, she's been studying the world's captive population of bonobos. And in all of her research, she uses an evolutionary approach to shed light on the origins of human behavior. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Amy Parrish and Peter Godfrey Smith to the LA Public Library.
Hi, everyone. Nice to be here. Thank you, Louise, for that great introduction. It's my pleasure tonight to be in conversation with Peter Godfrey Smith and talk about octopus. And one of my first questions is, it seems sort of awkward to call them octopuses. And in my family over Thanksgiving dinner, rather than talk about Trump, we talked about the plural of octopus. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, is that a discussion that happens to you as you travel? And
it does happen. Octopuses is where we should be, though. Yeah. Octopus is a Greek word, not a Latin word.
So octopody wouldn't work.
Well, octopi is out, okay. And octopodes would be very impressive, but yeah. No one can manage to do that more than a couple of times.
Okay, so octopuses it is.
Right.
Right. Well, I thought that we might start by talking about what exactly a cephalopod is, if you could kind of tell us what that encompasses and, in terms of kind of a systematic overview.
Sure. Well, they're a branch of the mollusks, so, the mollusks have their more familiar members, including clams and oysters and snails. And cephalopods are one notable class within the mollusks. The three conspicuous ones are octopuses, cuttlefish, and squid, where cuttlefish and squid are quite closely related, and octopuses are off to the side a little bit. And also the nautilus, that's also a cephalopod. Very different in lifestyle, quite different in appearance. It has an external shell, unlike the others. And that's about it for living. There's a couple of other minor groups, but those are the ones to have in mind.
So tonight we're going to talk about octopus and cuttlefish,
right.
In quite a bit of detail. As an anthropologist, I've always been interested in our closest living relatives and what we can learn about ourselves by understanding them, with the idea that because we shared a common ancestor relatively recently, 6 million years ago, that we could really be informed about our evolution and our history in that way. Tonight we're talking about quite a distant relative. I think in the book you said our oldest relative was the comb jelly, right?
There's currently, as we speak, a great debate about whether our most distant living relative is within the animals specifically. Is a sponge or a comb jelly. And that goes back and forth. Sounds like it's a fairly arcane discussion, but it does have some relevance to the sorts of topics we're talking about, because if comb jellies are our most distant relative, then probably nervous systems themselves evolved more than once, which would be an amazing evolutionary parallel or convergent event. Whereas if sponges are, then probably everyone who has a nervous system is descended from a single origination. So we don't want to downplay the importance of the sponge comb jelly question.
Exactly. You heard it here first. And so the last time that we were, that we diverged from the octopus, say, or from the cephalopods was 600 million?
About 600 million years ago.
Which, is quite a time span, and yet you talk in the book about some of the similarities that we have. It seemed like there were more differences than similarities, but I thought we might start with, what are the similarities between us and an octopus?
Okay. The eyes are a famous similarity. So if you go back that 600 million years, you get probably as that common ancestor, probably an animal perhaps about that big, a little worm, a flattened worm, maybe not flattened, but something kind of worm-like. It may have had eye spots, and it certainly had a nervous system, but the kinds of eyes that we have and that octopuses have are a particularly sophisticated eye called a camera eye, where we have a lens and a retina behind the lens, and light is focused to form an exact image on the retina. Camera eyes have evolved independently a couple of times, not just in the vertebrates and in cephalopods. But those are the two cases where you have a very sophisticated camera eye. So that's a famous and obvious similarity. Itself quite striking that in dealing with the world, this kind of eye should have been invented in a very similar form more than once. I think the subtler similarities, and the ones I'm most trying to understand, are sort of deeper in, less mm-hmm. peripheral than the eyes. So various kinds of learning, learning by tracking the consequences of one's actions, doing again the things that were successful, avoiding the things that weren't successful. That's probably evolved, I'm guessing, something like three times, something like that, certainly more than once. It's, again, very unlikely that the common ancestor had that kind of sophistication. And then we get to really odd things, such as being able to recognize individual, not just individuals of the same species, which there's less evidence for, but some in octopuses, but recognizing individual people over time, being able to sort of register that this person you saw is the same one you saw in the past, and this one's a good one, this is a bad one.
And even if they're wearing, if multiple humans are wearing the same uniform, they can distinguish.
That's right.
Different humans.
So for years, it was just an anecdotal claim, the idea that octopuses could remember individual people. But there's now been an experiment done where they tried to systematically study this, and just to sort of make it hard for the octopuses, they made the different people who behaved quite differently wear the same outfits, but still the octopuses could work out who was who.
And that seems like a remarkably kind of primate capacity to have, particularly for something that's in an aquatic environment and would never really encounter a human.
It's totally baffling. Well, it's either baffling or it says something, I think, that's philosophically quite substantial, which is that once you're dealing with the world with a certain degree of complexity, objects as repeatable things, this is the same object I saw yesterday, even though it appears in somewhat different circumstances today, thinking of the world as containing that sort of contents, the fact that octopuses can do it, even though it doesn't have obvious utility to them, and the fact that we can do it and it does have obvious utility to us, the fact that it was arrived at several times suggests something about the naturalness of that way of carving up the world or dealing with the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of how we classify intelligence, I think, a lot of the terrestrial animals have been kind of characterized in terms of their intelligence based on can they use tools, mm-hmm. can they recognize themselves? To what extent do those same criteria apply to an octopus?
Well, to pick those two... Well, let me say something general first. I think that one of the things that people often say, but one doesn't always see the sort of deep truth in, is that there are many different ways of being an intelligent animal, and octopuses are different from us in ways that make a sort of ranking, this animal is a smarter animal than that animal, especially inappropriate. And so, in the book, I tended to emphasize the more impressive things that they do, but they also are capable of doing spectacularly unimpressive things on occasion. They can be incredibly dumb animals in ways that baffle me. For example, we're going off a bit of a tangent, but I think that's okay. Sometimes octopuses are able to be completely invisible for someone looking for them. They are very good escape artists like the famous Inky. And in general can sort of take care of themselves in a hostile environment very well. At other times, if you want to catch one, it'll just sit there and do nothing in response to what look like obvious, look, octopus, I'm sure you'd rather not be captured, but this will happen very soon unless you behave differently. So there's a kind of, in many ways they're baffling animals, but even just with respect to sort of moment by moment impression of great sophistication versus this thing is just a mollusk. There's a continual kind of exasperation of any attempt to sort of work out what they're up to. Let me say a bit about the tool. So suppose a person said that tool use was a really important sign of intelligence in an animal. Well, that would then make octopuses very special because of the octopuses who are able to carry around pairs of coconut shells, one inside the other for carrying, and then turn them back into a sphere at will and thereby create a kind of mobile home. These are octopuses in Indonesia. That's not just a kind of... tool is not the most natural word for a portable home, but compound tool use, or the use of objects in a way that involves putting one in a particular arrangement with another. Yeah. My understanding is that's quite unusual, even in primates. There's only a few... Yeah. You may want to correct me or comment on this, but it's a somewhat unusual thing to sort of manipulate objects and make a compound tool like that?
Yeah, you know, originally, I think the tendency has always been that we want to think that we're special and separate from the so-called animals, although, of course, we are an animal. And so the original benchmark was, well, we are the tool users, man the tool user.
Right.
And when it turned out that chimps and then later crows and elephants and all kinds of animals, dolphins, use tools, then we moved the benchmark and said, well, it's more important to use tools to make other tools. I guess this coconut shell analogy would kind of fall into that category. It's kind of a second order use of an object in a way that shows some kind of modification or uh-huh. some kind of other purpose. So, I mean, chimps do that too, where they carry around hammers and anvils
right.
to crack nuts, and they take them from location to location. But it's certainly impressive that that kind of capacity has that kind of continuity from the terrestrial world into the aquatic world mm-hmm. and across, spanning so many millions of years. I was interested in reading your book because you also make a really good case for expanding our definition of intelligence and talking about some of the other capacities that octopuses have in terms of their curiosity and their spatial sense and their ability to explore. And I wondered if you wanted to maybe talk about that or give some examples.
Sure. The curiosity is something, it's one of the things that I find most interesting about this group. The fact that there's many situations, sometimes with octopuses, sometimes with cuttlefish, where you have a strong impression that we are as interesting to them as they are to us. Mm-hmm. I was at a conference a couple of years ago, and there was a woman there who studies birds and novelty in birds. And she said, well, yeah, it's hard to find because birds have a kind of neophobic tendency. A lot of birds don't like new things. They like the familiar. And I immediately thought, right, that's the opposite of the octopuses. There's nothing better than novelty to an octopus. They're neophilic rather than neophobic. So at the site down south of Sydney, where I go a lot to see octopuses, one of the things we've found, if you bring an object that has some use in our work, tape measures are a good example, there's a very good chance you won't get to the surface with your tape measure because octopuses find tape measures to be particularly interesting. They seem to like the orange, even though octopuses are supposed to be colorblind. Must be just something about the brightness. But even though tape measures are quite hard for an octopus to manipulate because of the sort of sharp edge of the metal tape, they are a very popular object.
And can they actually pull the tape measure out of the
Not on canister? Their own. Or at least I haven't seen them do it on their own. But there have been many situations where if I want to measure this distance between an octopus and something else, the octopus will hold the end for me while I...
Right on. Yeah. There was really a touching anecdote in here about an encounter you had where, you know, you're there looking at an octopus and it reaches out one arm and kind of wraps its tentacle around your finger. And for me, that was such a primate moment. I mean, you know, that's something that, you know, humans and monkey babies will do that really has kind of an emotional resonance, I think, for us as a mammal and a primate. And I just thought that was so interesting that you had that encounter with an octopus that kind of...
It does. And there's an extra... Well, I agree with the sort of primate-like nature of it, but there's an important... further feature of the interaction with an octopus is when it does that, it's tasting you. It's not just working out how you feel, but all those suckers have little organs of taste within them. So your chemical history will be apparent to the animal when it touches you. Cy Montgomery's octopus book has a very good page or so on this phenomenon, where if you touch an octopus, it's getting a lot more information than you might realize about what you've been up to.
Well, you're doing this really interesting work in Australia, and I thought that maybe we could talk a little bit about your site, which you all heard from Louise. It's called Octopolos, which is just a fantastic name, and maybe talk about why you think that octopuses come there, and then maybe we could show
sure.
one of the videos.
Yeah. So we should start with the second video. That's the one that gives a good sense of just the overall scene. So this is about 50 feet below the surface. It's on the east coast of Australia. And this is a fairly typical set of interactions that you'll see. So you've got an octopus, a sort of darkish one over underneath the diver there. And that darkness, and especially what it's doing now, is a sort of aggressive, an aggressive behavior. This other one is fleeing. And as they flee, they produce a sort of mottled color. Now, this one is there going over near one of our remote unmanned cameras as it chases that one off even further. So what you're seeing there, there's a lot of scallop shells, as you will have noticed. And whereas in most places it'd be unusual to see even three octopuses within a camera frame or within, you know, a few meters of each other, I think the record that we've had at this site is now 16 individuals. And if you have 16 octopuses in a small area, a lot more happens than normally happens. There's lots of behaviours that we don't usually see. Maybe actually we should put up why don't we talk a bit about the high fives?
Yeah, let's talk about the high fives.
So
that's number seven.
Number seven of the still images. This is a behaviour that we see at this site we're very interested in. So there's an octopus coming in under jet propulsion, and he's about to sort of go beside or over the top of two others. And they're both sort of reaching up a single arm. And what'll happen is there'll be a sort of contact between the arm and the octopus as it passes. Now, in my first papers about this site, I referred to this as boxing. Because often it does look like a kind of boxing. It's got a bit of a poke or a jab about it. But recently I went out to the site with a friend, Stefan, who's obviously a far better natured person than I am. Because he said, no, it's a kind of a high-five behavior. They're not boxing. It's a kind of just a sort of recognition slap or something like that. And I now think that's quite possibly the case, because once we start looking for them, we do see a lot more of these sort of gentle ones. And we don't know what this behavior really involves, but the conjecture we have is that it is to determine, you know, you can work out who is this octopus coming in. It's hard to recognize octopuses visually, even if you're an octopus, we assume, because they change color, they change shape so frequently. And a touch with those chemically sensitive suckers might at least give you an indication of its sex and possibly of other features. So it's a site where you've got lots of animals with this kind of unusual density. And the picture we have of a situation is that because of the unusual ecology, the unusual circumstances, these guys have just had to learn to get along in a way that octopuses don't usually have to learn to get along. I shouldn't be too definite about that. So this, I guess there's two ways of thinking about the site. One is that it shows that octopuses do hang out and interact more than people had supposed. People had formerly, have usually supposed that they're essentially asocial animals. We have them doing things like this. So one conclusion you might draw is that they're more social than people realize. I'm more inclined to think that octopuses are loners, but if they have to hang out together, they'll find a way. So you ask, you know, why they're doing it here. The best account we can give is that this particular location is in one sense octopus heaven and in one sense octopus hell. It's octopus heaven because there's literally unlimited food. Those scallop shells are the remains of countless thousands of live scallops which carpet this area. And scallops are not first choice for octopuses, but they're fairly high on the list of preferences. Crabs are often first choice for octopuses. So there's unlimited food, but it's a very dangerous place. There's several species of sharks, there's seals, there's dolphins, predators like that. And the sand is silty and fine. It's very hard to build a den that will protect you. So the picture we have, and this is certainly not proven, but I think it's a reasonable hypothesis, is that so on the far side of the very far left there, you can see a little bit of a mound there. There's a single hard object that looks like the old remains of a man-made object, originally metal, which we think was sort of dropped into this location, perhaps from a boat. And it provided one very good den for one octopus. So if you go there now, it's almost always the case that the biggest animal is living there. And this animal was successful. It ate a lot of scallops, began to leave a lot of shells, and that would eventually have provided building material far better than the sand to build, for some octopus to build another den. Once there's more than one there, even more shells are being brought in. So it's a kind of positive feedback process, we suspect. We've been watching this place for about 7 or 8 years now, a while, but we don't really know how it started. That's our best guess.
It's so fascinating. You know, it reminds me of a similar debate in orangutans, which are very solitary in the wild and yet are the easiest species to put together in captivity. And that was always a big mystery of why they seem to have the social capacity when they don't have much of a use for it. And now it turns out that once every 10 years, all of the fruit in the forests in Indonesia comes ripe at the same time. It's called a mast. And in those times, all the orangutans get together and hang out and eat together and socialize.
Okay.
And so the thought is that maybe in their past, food was distributed in a different way that allowed them to be more social than they can be now. And so it's a current environmental constraint that makes them look asocial. And so when I see something like this, I think, oh, I wonder if in the future we'll discover, hopefully before the ocean is, you know, is destroyed, habitats, you know, that are rich enough that you can see, you know, that it supports bigger groups. It would be kind
That's very interesting. I knew that orangutans were this puzzling case. I didn't know that it had been... people have worked out what's going on there, or at least have an idea.
And similar to octopuses as well, and kind of a curiosity about humans. And that's something, I mean, also about us. It's so interesting that we're interested in other animals. I mean, not every other animal is.
Right.
So that in itself.
Giant cuttlefish are, I mean, in some ways even more than octopuses. They're the first animals in this group that really got me thinking about these guys. And they can be extremely... curious.
You talk about how charismatic they are, and I thought that perhaps you might be willing to read one of your passages about one of the cuttlefishes that you gave a name to. It's this one here on page 114. About Matisse.
Matisse, yes. Right. So, actually, why don't we put up a picture while I'm doing this?
Which picture is?
Well, numbers. We should start with number 11, I think. That gives you a good sense of what the animals are like. But then we should, after I've read a bit, we'll go to number 6. Okay, but number 11. Right. So some individuals, friendly or not, have distinctive styles of colour change. I've occasionally encountered cuttlefish who seem to produce colours the others had not quite thought of, or patterns with particular brilliance. The first of these I named Matisse. He was a friendly cuttlefish I visited for several days some years ago. All his colours had particular detail, but something else set him apart. He would be hovering without fuss in some mixture of reds and whites, so that's a fairly typical mixture of reds and whites there, and would suddenly explode into bright yellow. This flood covered his entire body with no other marks visible and would be switched on in less than a second. One moment he would be dark red with veins and stripes, and in less than a second, he looked like a cuttlefish-shaped sun. The flare would then fade more slowly. Oranges would appear among the yellow and darken. Patterning would return, and in 10 seconds or so, he was dark red again.
Yeah.
Put up image 6. So this is not Matisse, but that's a pretty good yellow flare from another animal. And in this case, unlike Matisse, he's also, this is a male, he's also producing an aggressive pose in other respects. So the thing about Matisse that was puzzling is, I mean, to go completely yellow in less than a second, it seems like a kind of a startling, an attempt to startle perhaps, or something that indicates a kind of, you know, absence of calm, certainly. Mm-hmm. But Matisse would do it just in the most... calm manner in every other respect. Whereas this guy, I think this might be Brancusi, actually. Some of the cuttlefish favour sculpture over colour. And the ones who hold those sort of horn-like shapes for long periods, I tended to give sculptors names to. But that's some indication of the intense yellow. And again, that can come on in less than a second, and it fades over about roughly 10 seconds.
Well, and as you said, you know, there are some that are intensely friendly and intensely curious, and others that take this more aggressive pose. And so I just wondered if you could also read this paragraph about one of the other cuttlefish. I don't know if this is Kandinsky or not. Maybe you can tell me.
No, this is definitely not Kandinsky.
Okay.
Yeah.
But this is one on kind of the other end of the personality.
I'll give just a bit of setting. So a lot of cuttlefish have this sort of friendly curiosity, and on a few occasions, not when they're looking like this. Is there an image that would be useful? Maybe number 8. So number 8 is Kandinsky. Very colourful and also a fairly friendly cuttlefish.
He looks friendly.
Interested in. Yeah, it's got a kind of amiable look about it. And on some occasions I've been able to get very close and sort of reached out a hand, and a few times, in a very, very subtle way, I don't want to overstate the extent of its behaviour, it seems to me that they will ensure that there's a kind of bit of, so I don't touch them, they have to sort of touch me, and they'll just come forward a little extra, so there's contact, usually just once, usually after one contact they'll back off again. Anyway, but that's the friendly mode.
He looks like Snuffleupagus from Sesame Street.
I'm not familiar with that species. But
some of you might.
Anyway, here's, okay, and occasionally you meet one who's unfriendly. And this is also, another male cuttlefish who was particularly aggressive. And he used to chase me off. So on these chases, he produced the most murderous-looking displays I have ever seen. Burning orange colours, arms like horns and sickles, and skin folds resembling bent iron armour. Sometimes his inner arms were held high, contorted. At one point, he held nearly all his arms aloft and twisted together, with just one set of arms below and his face in between. I thought, he looks like the jaws of hell. It was as if he, in his molluscan way, had a real sense of what is frightening for a human and was trying to produce a vision of damnation, something intended to strike at our hearts.
So, I mean, they're obviously, fascinating in terms of the variability. And what do you think it is that they're responding to? Is it something about you that elicits either a friendly or an aggressive response? Or
I have absolutely no idea. and with octopuses, I've been studied quite a lot. You know, there's a fairly long history of laboratory work of different kinds on octopuses. With these animals, I mean, I think this should be surprising to everybody. They are so spectacular and quite big. You know, this animal is between 2 and 3 feet long when stretched out. It's not a small animal. It's a big, substantial animal. They're not rare. They're quite common. They are hardly ever studied. Very little is known about them. There's a woman, Karina Hall, there's a picture of her in the book, who's taught me a lot about them, and she's probably the world's expert on the Australian giant cuttlefish. But even she has not been able to write that many papers about them. And with respect to, I'll mention, there's also a young woman, Alexandra Schnell, who is now keeping them in a lab, and she says she's starting to see the kinds of quirky personality that people associate with octopuses. But they are genuinely mysterious animals. They have big brains. As a fraction of the whole body, octopuses and cuttlefish are sort of similar, and squid have less brain power proportionally. Mm-hmm. Big brains, complex behaviours, totally mysterious. They seem to have a lot of individual personality differences. I find that, you know, two individuals of the same sex, the same age, in the same place, will behave completely differently. And there's no way I can predict it. Yeah. So on the one hand, I can't say anything very informative in response to your question, but I think it's amazing how little we know about an animal as conspicuous as that.
And we have a tendency to venerate species that have really big brains for body size. And I think in the book you said the cuttlefish has an even bigger brain than an octopus.
It's
right?
Slightly, yeah, they're similar. Okay. But and all the figures here are somewhat sketchy. No one really knows how many neurons there are in an octopus. Mm-hmm. The standard figure is about 500 million in a common octopus, but that's...
As opposed to 100 billion in a human?
A bit less than, 86 billion, I think, is the current. Yeah, million. The figure came down in the time the book was in press. right, so we have a lot more, certainly.
But those are distributed in a really interesting way. Could you talk a little bit about
yes,
that?
Yes, sure. This is, I mean, when you think about the idea that octopuses are this independent experiment in how to build a brainy and complex animal, starting from that little worm 600 million years ago, the biggest difference from us is that we have most of our neurons in the obvious place, in our heads, and you need to have a whole bunch more elsewhere in the body to make things happen. But we're fairly centralized with respect to our sort of psychological control devices. Whereas in an octopus, more than half of the neurons are not in the obvious place in the head between the eyes, but are spread mostly through the arms and the upper arms, the upper part of the arms. So whereas in an animal like us, there's the smart part and there's the parts that are told what to do. In an octopus, in a sense, the whole body is its own controller. There's just neurons everywhere. It's a radically decentralized design.
I was reading, in your book and thinking it's, we have that expression about the tail wagging the dog. And
I never thought of that, but that is, right? That is indeed an appropriate comparison.
So you wrote about this interesting experiment in a lab with an octopus where they can see where their arm is going to reach a task, right?
Yeah, that's a good experiment. That was done just a few years ago in Benny Hockner's lab in Jerusalem, where they're asking the right question. So in earlier decades, when people looked at octopus anatomy, they thought there's surprisingly little connection between those nervous systems in the arms and the central brain. I mean, there's certainly some connection, but the connections looked slender, and the arms seemed to have a lot of autonomy. So it seemed unclear to what extent an octopus could tell its arms what to do. In the standard reference book on cephalopod behavior written by Roger Hanlon and John Messenger, they say it seems that the arms are curiously divorced from the brain. It's a nice expression. So Benny Hockner's group wanted to ask, okay, so if an octopus really wants to send an arm to one, definite location in a visually guided way, can it learn to do it? And it was hard to do the experiment because you had to make sure the arm couldn't find its own way there using its own sense organs. So the way they did that was to train the octopus to reach for something where the arm had to go out of the water and back in again. So it couldn't follow any kind of chemical trail if it left the water and then had to re-enter at a particular spot. And they were able to learn to do that. So octopuses can direct an arm visually down a particular path. I think it's worth emphasizing as well, though, that in this experiment and in many others, when you read the fine print, it was a real hassle to get the thing to get the octopus to sort of do what you want it to do is always very hard. They've got their own interests in the lab.
Imagine.
And the experiment is often the least interesting thing to them.
Right.
And I think it's a genuinely hard task for an octopus to send an arm to a destination with visual guidance only. But they could do it.
It's interesting that we think that that often we're the instigator of something like that, training the octopus to do something. And I know you mentioned Michael Pollan in your book, and I love his book, Botany of Desire, where he talks about plants that have really essentially domesticated us rather than us domesticating them. So marijuana, for instance, we're kind of cultivating it in their service in a way, and that's a really interesting thing. And I think in a lot of these experiments, part of the problem with identifying is an animal smart and in what way is it smart is whether we're asking the right question. So Diana Rees, I think when she was working with elephants in Thailand, she could show that the people who had tried to figure out if they could recognize themselves in a mirror hadn't designed the right kind of mirror. So it wasn't that elephants couldn't do the task, but the we hadn't designed the right equipment.
What was the
proportions were wrong. So they, it was like if you could only see this kind of square size of yourself.
Right? Okay.
Yeah. And then she had this. Some of you may have been here when she was Hear It Aloud, but she talked about training dolphins, and when they did the wrong thing, her signal for that was to walk backwards and cross her arms and kind of look at them in a stern way. Well, then when she did the wrong thing, giving them the wrong food, they backed up on their tail. They looked at her, right? So who knows what the octopus and cuttlefish are doing with you?
I would like to have something comparable that I do not.
It could be coming down. Yeah. You have some other great videos that I want to make sure we have a chance to see them. What do you suggest between the other two?
Well, maybe we should start with number one. I don't want to give the impression that at Octopolis that everything is full of camaraderie and good-natured interaction. There's a lot of fighting. And so this is an octopus who was the most aggressive and successful one we ever saw. And this is him getting into a sequence of fights. So he first beats up this one, who jets away. And then rather than... Okay, there's a shot of the guy recovering.
Yeah.
And then rather than resting on his laurels, he comes and beats up this one.
Is he biting him or just wrestling with him? Do we know?
Well, okay, yeah. Actually, can we go play the first bit of it again? Because I hadn't realized how well it connects to one thing I was talking about. And I'll come to this. Exactly. So if you see here, there, that's in a natural situation. And it looks a lot like a visually guided single arm.
That's true.
Directing. Yeah. So, and also one where the octopus creates an elbow. So it doesn't just send the arm out like a telescope. It sort of builds an elbow and then, or a sort of whip-like motion. Okay, right. So what are they doing? I was talking about this just before the conversation when Amy and I were chatting, and she said she, it's hard to watch them being so sort of mean. One thing it took me a long while to realize this. I think it's very hard to fight if you're an octopus. I think it's hard to do damage to the other individual. I mean, they can sometimes. There are cases where octopuses have killed other octopuses. But I think in situations where the two are both of decent size, it's pretty difficult. Yeah. So there's a lot of that wrestling. Yeah. And as you can see, they're trying to bring the underside of the body into contact with the other, and that's where the beak is. So I assume there's an attempt to bite going on. But in all the fights we've seen at Octopolis, I've never seen anyone get seriously hurt, not a single individual. Usually what happens is someone gives up and they start trying to extricate themselves, and it might be hard to get out, but they are usually allowed to get out, and they just sort of zoom away. I've never seen an octopus be killed by another at this site, which is, I think...
And do you know that octopus? Does he have a name?
He doesn't have a name. A lot of the best. Let's go to video number three.
Yeah, I thought we should see three.
This video we used in our paper about display behavior. But this is actually the same. This is the same guy. We think of this as an aggressive display. I mean, unsurprisingly, given how it looks, we call it the Nosferatu display. So the animal rises up and it spreads its web very far, and we think it's trying to look as big and dark as it can, and here it chases away another octopus. Now this one, the one who's now figured in both those two videos, he was the most successful aggressor we ever saw, we've seen so far. We didn't give him a name for no particular reason. There's a high five. I think you might see another high five. No, not there.
Does he occupy the big house?
He didn't want the big house. And that was a bit puzzling. He tried to control the site, it seemed. So anyone who came onto the site, he would, in most cases, either chase them away or let them on after vetting them. We suspect he was letting females on and chasing away males, but we don't know. He's definitely a male, but we're not able to tell the sexes of at least half the individuals. But it's hard to work out octopus sexes with this species especially. There's a groove running down one of the arms, the third right arm, with which they place sperm. And the only infallible way is to turn them over and look at the third right arm, but they hate that, as you can imagine. And we don't want to interfere with them. We don't want to interact with them against their will, essentially. Right. So we don't mess with them if they're not interested in interacting. And so we never get to look at the underside of their arms. So the only way we can work out sex is by looking at behaviour. If it mates as a male, we score it as a male. If it accepts a mating, we treat it as female, although I occasionally wonder if sometimes there might be some confusion that creeps in. Because the mating is kind of long distance most of the time. So if I was a male octopus and you were a female, I would send out the arm. I wouldn't normally get very close to you.
And you would hand me a sperm packet that I would put into a special receptacle.
Yeah.
Under my chin. Well, not a chin.
But under your
under
chin.
My, under your, my head.
Basically under your chin.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's really fascinating, this that kind of mating system where females are handed sperm packets, because you don't necessarily have to use them. You could mate with several males. And, it's great for female mate choice, because you can collect sperm packets as an insurance policy to make sure you have some, but then you get to choose which ones you use. And I remember reading in Cuttlefish that males have two strategies, kind of the, act like a big rough and tough male or disguise yourself as a female.
Yeah.
And a lot of species will do this where males will have the two strategies, but I believe it's the only data where females were selecting the sperm packets from the kind of beta male strategy, the kind of alternative strategy.
That was very interesting. And I think that was a paper by Karina Hall, the woman I mentioned earlier, if I remember rightly. It did seem that it wasn't that they were only going for that. I remember rightly, there was a little bit of a preference, perhaps, or at least a good chance of being the successful male if you were doing the second option.
So they're fascinating in so many ways. I mean, certainly in terms of the distribution of the neurons, the kinds of intelligence that they have, the fact that they might have this kind of intelligence in perhaps the absence of a lot of sociality. And then also in terms of longevity, and I wanted to make sure that we had a chance to talk about that.
Sure, yes. That was such a surprise to me when I learned it. So it was about 8 years ago, I first began running into the giant cuttlefish off the waters of Sydney and thought, okay, this is an amazing animal. And in some cases, I was able to follow individuals for several days and up to a week or so, because though they change colour all the time, there are usually scars you could use to work out who you're with. And, I couldn't say I was friends with them or anything like that, but I felt there was a little bit of contact there. And then when I began reading about them, almost the first thing I learned was that they have these incredibly short lives, 1 to 2 years in the case of giant cuttlefish and most octopus species. 1 to 2 years is a very common lifespan for these animals, which is, it's baffling. I mean, to build all that brain power and only use it for such a short time, it just makes the whole thing more puzzling.
So is that something you plan on continuing to investigate in the future? Where is your research headed?
I do very low-tech research.
Okay.
I think that might take more tech than I... So this began as a hobby. I just began swimming around. And then my friend Matt Lawrence, the diver you've seen in the background a couple of times, he discovered Octopolis, and I began going there. And we're starting to make that research a bit more systematic. That I am terrible in labs. I think the field is my only chance of doing any scientific contribution is to be in the field with the animals. And some questions like that question, I think, would be quite hard to study in that kind of context.
Right. Well, we're going to open it up for questions in just a minute, but I want to make sure at the end of the book you really address climate change and concerns about that, and I wanted to offer a space for some kind of discussion about that.
Sure, it's a particular kind of concern. It's hard to work out what climate change will do to cephalopods, but some of the indications are not good. And the worrying aspect of climate change is the acidification of the oceans, the change in the pH balance of the oceans. It's thought that that is not good news for lots of invertebrates, but cephalopods among them. They don't mind pretty weird, dirty water in many ways. So quite a few of the octopus sort of anecdotes in the book, and I think probably none of the photos here, but a lot of my octopuses, other than the ones at Octopolis, are in Sydney Harbour. I mean, Sydney Harbour, city of 4 million people and a working harbour, the water is pretty good, but it's still an urban context, mm-hmm. and there's lots of refuse and spills and things like that. And the octopuses are fine with it. They quite enjoy a little bit of somewhat exotic exotic water. But acidification is not good, right. apparently. Right. It will be metabolic. It'll be sort of chemically quite damaging. And the idea that we could be slowly making the oceans, you know, not just depleted of fish, but more and more chemically unfriendly to animals like this is very concerning indeed.
Dire consequence. Thank you so much. This has been really enjoyable.
Sure. Thanks.
We are recording for podcasts, so we have people with mics that will come around to you. We do ask that your question is actually a question, and we'll take as many as we can.
So my question is, with such a short lifespan, can you talk a bit about the growth process from baby essentially to adult? And with such a short lifespan, has anybody ever tried to, I don't want to say domesticate, but have an octopus as a pet?
People do have them as pets. They're quite popular pets. There's a website, if you become curious about this, there's a website called Tonmo, which stands for various things, but one thing it stands for is the Octopus News Magazine Online, tonmo.com, which has both scientists and also people who just have them as pets writing about their experiences and swapping advice and things like that. So it's definitely possible. On the first point, they have spectacularly fast rates of growth. I mean, you know, their diet is just all protein. They're continually taking in protein. And the rate of conversion of food to octopus is apparently very unusual. They're very, very, very efficient at growers. And so even the giant squid, a huge animal, no one knows really how old those guys are, but the figure that you see around the place is about 5 years for those. So it's still a very short life. In, you know, a truly enormous animal. So, right, I mean, as you say, the fact that they're so short-lived and that they get big is indicative of an unusual metabolism.
I have two questions. One is, what exactly is the difference between a squid and a cuttlefish? And number two, how do you feel about eating cephalopods?
Okay, squid versus cuttlefish, so they're the closest relatives of each other. Can we put up number 12, image 12? So this is just a nice photo of some cuttlefish in South Australia. Wow. So, you know, a cuttlefish is a flatter animal with a sort of surfboard-like hard part in its back, which squid don't have. They have that thing called a pen that looks like it's made of plastic. Squid, interestingly, are much more social animals. They tend to school in many cases. And, you know, other than that, just ordinary sorts of differences. They both have 8 arms and 2 extra feeding tentacles, whereas octopuses just have the 8 arms. Now, on the eating question, I don't eat octopuses. I would have to say, though, I think of that as, to some extent, a sort of a sentimental decision. I just have too much liking for them. I don't think of them as food. I think if you compare eating octopuses to various other kinds of meat eating, they would not be one of the more problematic forms, even though they're very complicated animals. So, for example, you know, I don't think ranking exercises mean too much, but I would think that pigs would be animals who are spectacularly complicated animals and are treated particularly badly in farming contexts within mainstream modern farming. So I think cases like that are the clear cases, you know, where a lot of harm is being done to an animal that really is able to suffer. And feedlot-based cattle farming, battery hens and things like that. I think of those as a totally different category from octopuses, which are they're wild caught, you can't really farm them. Apparently one group did try to farm them, but I mean the expression herding cats is suggestive here. Very hard. I mean, you can't even keep the things captive in a lab without them getting out. To keep them, sort of hundreds of them in a farm would be very difficult indeed. So they're wild caught, they're short-lived, and they're not endangered, at least not presently. So even though I never eat octopuses, I couldn't say that, and given that I'm not completely vegetarian, I don't think of that as... I don't think octopuses are a sort of clear case where, you know, you should think, okay, veal, bad, foie gras, bad, octopuses next. I don't think there's much basis for thinking like that. I do eat calamari, for example. I probably shouldn't admit that here.
Oh, no, I think we're going here in the back.
Yes, unless you were being apocryphal and funny, how did you get your tape measure back?
Never did. No. So we buy the cheapest tape measures possible, and I mean we'd have to anyway because they don't have stainless steel inside them, so they rust very quickly. But the chance of it being taken by an octopus is a high chance.
Could that clam area be a lek?
Ah. Maybe you should say what a lek is for the rest of the audience.
So in some animal, you probably would
So the appropriate there are different kinds of strategies for finding mates. And one strategy is where lots of males, usually males, gather together and display, and females can come and watch all of the displays and then pick the male that they like the best. So maybe it's an antelope, how high they spring up, or if it's a bird, the complicated nature of the courtship dance. And so it's efficient rather than having to move through lots of different territories. You have them all in one place, and it's kind of like the shopping mall, and you can pick the... Yeah.
Right.
That's an interesting question.
It is. I don't think so. Partly because the animals are there all year, and there's some seasonality to the reproduction. We've seen the mating all through the year, but there seems to be a lot more mating in the summer than there is the rest of the time. And it just looks as if it's a permanent setup rather than a place where there's gathering for a particular reproductive purpose.
Yeah, hi. Ooh. Okay. I was wondering if you've noticed different cognitive abilities across different species of octopus. We see such differences across the primates, for instance. Are there any species of octopus that you feel have particularly unique abilities of cognition or anything like that?
I think people who work with many species do think that. I'm only familiar really with one species. So this species, should we put up just a little sort of portrait shot, number four. So this is just a sort of straight up shot of, I think it's actually the same aggressive male that we've been seeing all evening. So this is Octopus tetricus, which is the main Australian octopus on the East Coast. Its common name is the gloomy octopus. Not really made clear from that photo why it's called the gloomy octopus. If you saw a picture of a much younger or smaller individual, you would see why, because they have these big eyes that have a kind of world-weary kind of appearance out them in relation to the rest of the body. But once they get as big and sort of aggressive as that, it's not so gloomy. These guys are a close relative of the common octopus, such an unkind name, which is the Mediterranean species that has been studied the most. So most of the science is done on the common octopus, and they are very lively animals. They're, you know, particularly inquisitive, very interactive in labs and things like that. And our guys are relatives of theirs. I'm told, and because I'm, you know, I'm not a professional octopus biologist. This is a sort of hobby gone mad. That's the basis for all this. My understanding is that a great many of the species, there's roughly 300 species of octopuses, of which at least a dozen or two dozen are sort of kept and studied from time to time. And many of them are much quieter. You know, they don't do so much. My vague impression is three of the most lively are, you know, these guys, the common octopus, and fortunately, the giant Pacific octopus, the huge ones that are in many aquariums, sort of, especially on the West Coast.
I told Peter that they remind me of Dementors. I don't know if that evokes in the same way for all of you, but something about the way that they glide and then the dark color and even the shape, just kind of the cape. So
this was lost on me, unfortunately.
He didn't know the Harry Potter reference.
But the second species.
No. Well, the other species is Sesame Street.
Yeah.
It's not exactly a species. Let's see.
Hi. In the wild, do you see them ever get out of the water the way you, it's in the videos, there's lots of them online. And I just wonder, how do they navigate when they get out there? Can they see? I mean, how do they know where they're going? Or can you talk about that?
I've never seen them get out. That would be great to be following on around and see that happen. I've never seen it. Their navigation across the board is surprisingly good. I mean, I spend lots of time, if I find an octopus that looks like it's sort of restless in a den, not at this site so much, but just around Sydney, if it gets up and goes, I'll follow it, and it's usually going looking for food. And it's often the case that they'll go out in some big looping path and then come back from a different direction, from the direction they went out, and find their den again in water that's not very clear. Often. So I've got no idea how they do that, whether they have a kind of spatial map of their environment that they make use of, or whether they're just very good at some kind of following a scent, a plume of some chemical that's associated with that spot. They're just good at navigating in ways that are not well understood.
Thank you. I saw a video recently of an octopus attacking a seal, and it looked like it was a death struggle. Can they kill seals? And what about the giant squid? Can they be dangerous to humans?
The ones that can be dangerous to humans are the Humboldt squid, which are not giant squid. They're smaller, but big enough to be a real handful, apparently. So they are aggressive animals, and not much is known about them, I think, in part because studying them is, you know, quite a risky thing to do. I would have thought seal versus octopus, it's going to be no contest. But the seal would come out on top. I think I may have seen this video or just watched fragments of it at some point myself. You don't want to underestimate them.
What's the survival value of the fact that they can recognize people? How do they use that in their environment? And also, how do they usually die?
The survival value of that, I assume that it's just a byproduct. There isn't one. The assumption I and others make, I think, is that, you know, once you're smart enough and you've got good enough eyes for other reasons, this might just come along for free. It doesn't have any function. That's what I would expect. As far as death goes, on the female side, it's quite poignant. So with female octopuses, in almost every case, they only produce one clutch of eggs, and they look after the eggs very, full time until the eggs hatch, not eating during that period. They just stay there with the eggs. And after that one pregnancy, after that one lot of eggs hatch, the larvae float off into the sea, and the female octopus dies quite soon after. In the male case, they too, there's no reason for them to have such short lives that's as obvious as that. You know, it's not the case that they're doing something useful that would preclude them from feeding. But they too have short lives, and there's just a kind of a sort of falling apart, really, a sort of accelerated senescence.
Well, and that's so, oh my gosh.
Can we put up number 11?
Yeah, when you describe it in the book, it's just heart-wrenching the way that they die.
It is. So this shot, this is a cuttlefish showing the very first signs of a decline that, once it gets going, happens quite quickly. And the first signs are those kind of white, sort of cobwebby lines
on the outside
of the arms there. So that's the sign that there's a kind of a loosening of the color-changing part of the skin. It starts to sort of become fragile and poorly attached. And once that starts to happen, you know that the animal is on the way out. And that's not what kills it. They become helpless, and they can be eaten by pretty much anything. Their eyes seem to stop. Well, the eyes start to look as if they're not working very well at a certain point. They look as if they've got cataracts, like really bad cataracts. They're sort of cloudy kind of look in the eyes. And that happens on a scale of, you know, certainly sort of a couple of weeks from looking in full bloom of health to being close to the end.
Peter, you're not a biologist, but a philosopher. How common is it for a philosopher of science to enter into this kind of empirical research? Are you an anomaly? Are you part of a tradition? Could you just address that a little bit?
I'm a bit of an anomaly. there've been quite a few philosophers who have had sort of former lives in many parts of science. I'm a bit the opposite, so I don't have much scientific training. I did some coursework at university, but I'm not a professional biologist by any stretch, and never was. I've just become a bit obsessed with these animals. I've had to sort of teach myself as I go. And to do field work, I think, is a bit unusual among philosophers. Quite a few of them find their way into labs for various reasons. Mm-hmm. But to be sort of swimming around trying to keep up with them in the sea is not as common.
So at what point do they mature and reach reproductive age? And can that have a connection to their lifespan? So is it very early on, and are they able to reproduce? And
this has a hidden relationship to the previous question. I don't know enough about enough species, I think, to generalize very well. Certainly, the guys I watch, there's not much time. So with the giant cuttlefish, for example, some of them are reproductively mature in less than a year. And then they are out of the picture in well under two. So they really only have a year or so. And in that case, they're very seasonal. So they tend to be, I guess, born in the early part of the year, and their sort of reproductive period is around April, May, June, July. Then they'll die. With octopuses, you know, I shouldn't guess too much about other species. With the species I spend time with, they have, I think, a longish period when they're reproductively capable, at least the males. I mean, certainly you see ones of very different sizes and apparent ages attempting mating behaviours of various kinds. But I shouldn't go out on the limb and I think, answer more fully. Mm. Well, I agree it's relevant, but then the question is, well, why not go on for longer? Why not do it again? You know, the fact that you can start early doesn't itself mean you shouldn't keep going. And in the case of male octopuses, for whom mating is not that big a deal in terms of, you don't have to sort of look after the kids or anything, I don't... I don't think anyone really understands why they don't hang around or try to hang around for longer than they do. Now, there's a body of theory in biology that bears directly on this, trying to explain why some animals just go for broke in one season, you know, and just do the whole thing in one hit and not try to survive for a second one. I've been emailing a bit with, I guess, the guy who works on this, Rick Charnoff. There's a body of theory there, but I think in some, at least some of the cases here, like the male octopus, it's really not clear why they're doing what they're doing.
I think that that was our last question. Peter, thank you so much for being here tonight. Thank you to all of you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.